Thanks to all of you for turning out to hear what I have to say, and more particularly for what you're doing, because what you're doing is really important. You are on the front line of a critical struggle for this nation and for really the future of humanity. I myself, as Mike said, I'm actually an aerospace engineer. I spent most of my career working on designing human missions to Mars, and it's really my passion. I think there's a possible great future waiting for humanity beyond this planet. But on September 11th, 2001, I'm sitting there watching the buildings burn, and I'm saying to myself, what can I do about this? Okay? Well, I'm an engineer. And I'm looking at this thing going on, looking at this attack, and I'm looking at a movement, an enemy that is being funded by oil. What to do about that? So I set myself to thinking about this, and I came up with a plan, which I lay out in the book, Energy Victory, which, by the way, they've got in the BBI store downstairs. After the talk, if you think this is interesting, you buy them, I'll sign them. It's a win-win situation. So, now, in the years since September 11th, this situation has actually gotten much worse and more critical, as I'll discuss. And the solution that I'm going to put forward is even more essential. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about what's going on. In 1972, the United States paid $4 billion for oil imports. That was equal to about 4.5% of our defense budget for that year. In 1999, we paid $40 billion for oil imports. That was about 15% of our defense budget. In 2007, we paid $342 billion for oil imports. That was almost 70% of our defense budget of last year. And this year, the United States is going to import 5 billion barrels of oil at $130 a barrel. That comes out to $650 billion, so which is 130% of our defense budget for this year. So it's five times the cost of the Iraq War. So not only are we, as many people have said, funding both sides in the war on terror, we've been doing that for a while, but now we're actually funding the other side more than we're funding our own side. Okay. Now, and indeed, it is the case. I mean, look, you know, in most things in life and in business, when you buy something, the only thing you care about is getting a high-quality product for the best possible price. But when you're talking about spending $650 billion on something, there's another issue that comes into the equation, and that is who is getting the money and what are they going to do with it? Because this kind of money, $600 billion, this isn't just money. This is power. This is power to do good, power to do evil. So how's the money being used? Who's getting it? Well, the largest single recipient of international oil revenues by far is Saudi Arabia. Okay? They also are the leaders of OPEC, which collectively controls 40% of the world oil market. They are the controlling interest in world oil. The American oil companies all put together have an 8% share in the world oil business. OPEC has a 40% share. They are the controllers. And Saudi Arabia is the controller of OPEC. They are as big as the next four OPEC members combined. Okay. Now, what are they doing with it? Well, a lot of the money they just waste on palaces, yachts, racehorses, concubines, crack cocaine, and so forth, the most amazing set of narcissistic expenditures the world has ever seen. But they also use large amounts of this to promote their true passion, which is their cult, which is Wahhabism, which is an extremely intolerant version of Islam. Okay, it's not the same thing as Islam in general. It's one particular kind, and it's extremely intolerant, and it, among other things, it prescribes the enslavement or extermination of Christians, Hindus, Jews, Buddhists, Taoists, animists, atheists, etc. And they have set up over 20,000 madrasas around the world, not counting those inside of Saudi Arabia, that teach young boys that the way to go to heaven is to kill Christians, Jews, well, all these people that I've just discussed. And then they have an entire alphabet soup of front organizations that then recruits these graduates into various actual terrorist movements. And they have organized jihads, not just the ones you hear about frequently in the newspaper, but against Christians in Biafra and Nigeria, against secular Muslims in Algeria, against black Africans of various kinds in Darfur and the Sudan, against Jews in Israel, against American troops and Shiite Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan, against Russian Orthodox Christians in former Soviet Central Asia, against Hindus in India and Kashmir, against Buddhists in Thailand and Indonesia, against Catholics in the Philippines. And of course, we had our own 9/11 affair here. And this jihad, on a global scale, has cost millions of lives. Now, of course, they're not the only ones doing that. There's also Iran, which is a different thing, okay? And they have their own terrorist movements that they support, Hezbollah. They, you know, Saudi Arabia and Iran and terrorism is kind of like Hertz and Avis. Saudi Arabia's Hertz. Iran is Avis. They're number two. They try harder. And they're also using their money as well to develop atomic bombs. And then you have people who are not exactly the same sort, but Hugo Chavez, a Marxist, is using his oil revenues to consolidate a tyranny in Venezuela, which was moving towards democracy prior to that, and has also invited Hezbollah into Latin America. They are setting up Hezbollah training camps in Venezuela, okay, which will completely change the nature of the problem on our southern border. So this is really bad news. But as bad as it is, okay, the casualties that these people have caused with their terrorism pale in comparison to the casualties they have taken on the world through their rigging of oil prices. Because what you have to understand is that the oil price rise that OPEC has effected is a massively regressive tax against the world population. It's bad enough paying $130 a barrel for oil when you live in a wealthy country like the United States. It's another thing if you live in a place like Kenya or Haiti or one of these places. It's crushing. Okay? Now, let's just talk about this, okay? Because it is important to understand who is to blame on this oil price rise. The media is very confused, you know. I mean, you know, big oil, the oil companies, the gas station owners. No, it's OPEC. And here's the proof. Here's what's been going on, okay? This chart, okay, this is non-OPEC oil production. This is OPEC oil production in red. Black is the price between 1973 and 2007. Now, if you look at non-OPEC oil production, what you see is that over this period, a third of a century, during which time the world economy has doubled in size, non-OPEC oil production has also doubled in size from around 24 million barrels a day in 1973 to around 45 in 2007. That's what you'd expect to see, a growing industry serving a growing market. Now look at OPEC oil production. Well, it's wild. It's up, it's down, it's all over the place in accord with arbitrary decisions of the cartel's leader to turn the taps on and off. Okay, so they are manipulating the market. But the other thing that's really, truly remarkable is in 1973, they were 30 million barrels a day. And in 2007, they're 30 million barrels a day. That is over a third of a century, during which time the world economy has doubled in size. OPEC production has not increased at all. Okay, despite the fact that they're sitting on top of 80% of the world's oil reserves, including all the easiest to drill stuff. So what they are like, okay, imagine a cruel dog owner that puts a collar nice and snug around the neck of a puppy and leaves it set there without letting it out while the dog grows. So the collar gets tighter and tighter and tighter until it chokes the dog to death. That's what they are doing. Now, it's not the growth of the dog that kills the dog. Dogs grow. That's what they should do. That's natural. Okay, it is the cruel dog owner. So somebody says to you, the reason why world oil prices are soaring is because of increased demand in China and India. That's baloney. I mean, yes, there is increased demand from China and India. There should be. Those economies should grow. The problem is that OPEC is constraining production in the face of growing world demand. World demand grew much more between 1945 and 1973. World economic rates of growth in the post-war period were 6% a year. Okay, German economic miracle, Japanese economic miracle, etc., rebuilding Europe. Okay, and the oil production of the OPEC countries grew from just a few million barrels a day in 1945 to 30 in 1973. It went up tenfold in the previous third century. But in 1973, there was a change in management. Okay, and the control of world oil passed out of the hands of the Seven Sisters, okay, into the hands of these tyrannies who are not concerned with the health of the economies of the industrial world, let alone the third world, okay, and they changed policy. And this is what is going on, okay, and they intend to choke this thing to death. They are not at all concerned with the economic well-being of the rest of the world. Okay. Now, when you hear about the problem of our dependence on foreign oil, one of the things that comes up very quickly is the threat of another embargo, because people, or at least a lot of people, remember that. Remember 1973, 74, the gas lines, the factories shutting down, and all of that. Could that happen again? You bet it could happen again. Okay, but this time it would be a lot worse, because in 1973, we were only 30% dependent on foreign oil. Now, as a result of a third of a century of complete fecklessness on the part of the political class in this country, far from fixing that problem, we are 60% dependent on foreign oil. So the effects of an embargo would be far more catastrophic. But here's the real kicker. In 1973, the Arabs did not have much in the way of financial reserves. Oil had been selling for $2.50 a barrel up until the day of the embargo. They could not sustain it for more than a few months. Okay? Now they have trillions in financial reserves. Okay? They could sustain it a very long time. This is a disaster waiting to happen. We're up against it's like being up against a union with a $1 trillion strike fund. They're in position to shut this thing down as long as necessary. But they're more subtle than that, because an outright embargo like 73 could, in principle, provoke a military response. So they're instead of the immediate complete shutoff, they're doing the slow choke. Okay? And their financial power is growing at an extraordinary rate. Okay, in the yellow dots here, you can see that is the United States federal government revenues. And, a few years ago, it was 5 times the size of the world oil business as a whole and 10 times the size of OPEC. Now the world oil business is actually a larger financial power than the United States federal government, and OPEC is 60% as large as the U.S. federal government. Okay? OPEC, I think everybody knows, collection of 13 tyrannies, kleptocracies, and what have you, that control the world oil. Okay. Now, that much money, in addition to being a means of promoting terror and so forth, is also actually more potent, potentially, using legal means of activity. Okay? I mean, just think about this for a minute. This year, OPEC, at $130, okay, assuming it doesn't keep going up, which it could well do, okay, but just to assume somehow that it'll stay where it is going to clear $1.5 trillion in net export profits, okay? The entire worth of the U.S. Fortune 500 is $18 trillion. So at their current rate of profit, OPEC will accumulate enough money to get majority control of every company in the U.S. Fortune 500 within 6 years. So what is at stake here is our independence. Now, also, they're doing takeovers in Europe. Okay, the Saudis have launched a $900 billion sovereign wealth fund to do corporate takeovers of this kind. They have bids in for Citibank. They have bids in for other things. A Saudi prince bought 5.6% of the Wall Street Journal. You want to know why ethanol can't get a fair shake in the Wall Street Journal? Why they will not print a line that reveals the facts that Bob Dineen spoke of in here? Last week they had an editorial blaming ethanol for slavery, if you can believe it. Okay. It's because they're partially Saudi-owned. Okay, it should be called the Wahhabi Street Journal. Okay. But they're not even going to have to buy this stuff for their nominal price right now of $18 trillion, because they've got a way to reduce that price, and that's by taxing the industrial world into a depression. All right? I mentioned we're paying $650 billion for foreign oil this year. We're going to pay another $400 billion for domestic oil. That's $1 trillion Americans are going to pay for oil this year, up from $80 billion in 1999. $1 trillion divided by 300 million Americans is $3,300 a person, man, woman, and child in this country, working or not, or $13,000 for a family of four. The average American worker makes $45,000 a year before taxes, maybe $35,000 after taxes. So here's a third of disposable income is actually going for oil. That's up from 3% in 1999. Is it any wonder that these people aren't buying houses? So this kind of tax, okay, this is enough to force the economy into a recession. $1 trillion is 40% of what the IRS raises. So this is like a 40% tax increase, except it's not going for free health care or free college or any a number of other desirable programs that someone perhaps of liberal persuasions might think we should have taxes to pay for. No, instead of money, this money going to Uncle Sod, it's Uncle Sam, it's going to Uncle Sod, okay? You know, so this big a tax is big enough to force us into recession. You collapse the housing market, you collapse the mortgage markets, you collapse the banks. This is exactly what happened to Bear Stearns. And the sovereign wealth funds, okay, that the Saudis and the other oil kingdoms have put together were directly involved in the Bear Stearns takeover at 10 cents on the dollar. They crashed it and they bought it. Okay, that's what's going on. Okay, now, and the... It's even worse than that because in addition to this being a $1 trillion tax on the USA, this is a $4 trillion tax on the world economy. They're taxing our trading partners, our customers are all being taxed in exactly the same way. Okay? And this tax that is big enough to push the United States into a depression, okay, and that's what we're talking about here. The issue here is not $4 a gallon gasoline. That is a nuisance. Okay, I mean, that's bad, don't get me wrong, that's bad. But the issue is that the price of oil feeds into the price of food and every product that is transported, it even feeds into the price of service industries because they fly on airplanes to do their business. Okay, we're talking here about businesses shutting down, people losing their farms, people losing their houses, people losing their jobs. We're seeing this already. This is what's involved. And this kind of tax that's big enough to force rich countries like the United States into recession and depression is big enough to force third world countries into starvation. Now, this situation can be expected to get worse if nothing is done about it, okay? Because here is the data. This is data from the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security. And, okay, the light blue bar shows what the world oil reserves fractional ownership was in 2002. The dark one is projected for 2020 based on current rate of use. And you can see that in 2002, the Middle Eastern countries, including North Africa, had about 70%. They will have 83% by 2020, 83% of what is left. North America had 4 in 2002. It will have 1 in 2020. So this is one reason why I'm not that excited about the idea of drilling in Anwar in Alaska. I actually think we can drill in Alaska without undue environmental effects if appropriate regulations are put in place. And I don't really think that blocking such drilling is really useful. But it's not the answer here. We're importing 5 billion barrels of oil. There's only 16 billion barrels in Anwar. Okay, so this is a card we may have to play at some point, but it's a desperation play. It's one of the last strong cards in our hand. Okay, it's not the answer. It's not the way to win this game. So, I mean, you know, in a lot of card games, there's a trump suit, you know, like in bridge. Okay, if spades are trump, it means that any spade, even the little two of spades, can beat the ace of hearts or the king of diamonds. Okay, it's superior. Okay, and it's a major element of strategy in such games to try to have the trump suit be the one in which your side has most of the cards. So if between you and your partner you got 10 of the 13 spades, it'd be great for you if spades were trump. On the other hand, if the other side had almost all the hearts, it'd be a disaster for you if hearts were trump. Well, it's the same way in energy. There's four suits. There's oil, there's coal, there's natural gas, and there's biomass. Okay, and right now oil is the trump suit. Okay, the reason why oil is trump is because while there's any number of ways to generate electricity, both from those fuels as well as from nuclear power, solar power, wind power, what have you, right now, from a practical point of view, in the large scale, there's only one way to power vehicles. that is cars, trucks, airplanes, even things like ships and trains that used to move by coal are now pretty much all driven by petroleum products. And this is what makes petroleum the Trump fuel. It's the thing that makes things move. It's the thing that makes military force move. It's the thing that makes commerce move. It is the decisive strategic commodity in the world. And it is the fuel that is the enemy's long suit. Okay? And that's why we're losing the game. If we could change the Trump suit, for instance, if we could change the Trump suit to coal, we'd be in pretty good shape. The United States has immense reserves of coal and a lot of coal mining capacity. Many of our allies are pretty strong in coal. These OPEC countries, not so well. That'd be one alternative. Natural gas, so-so. Biomass, we're very strong there. As you know, we have a terrific agricultural sector in this country, and many of our allies do as well. And also, however, certain other countries, which have been losers in almost any other Trump suit, countries in Africa, Latin America, tropical agricultural countries, they would start to have a fairly strong hand, too. Okay, Saudi Arabia, not so hot. So the question is, how do we change the Trump suit? That's the winning play here, okay? You got to get the game out of the other guy's hand. Or to just switch metaphors here, imagine you had to face off an athletic competition against Muhammad Ali. Would you choose boxing or perhaps sailboat racing? Okay. You know. So you got to change it to your game, not their game. Here's my one-point program for accomplishing that. The United States Congress should pass a law requiring that all new cars sold in the United States be flex-fueled. That simply be the standard. They got to have a steering wheel. They got to have brakes. And they got to be flex-fueled. Well, I see people here know what a flex-fueled car is. I'll amplify on it, though, a little bit. Okay, flex-fueled cars can run on any combination of alcohol or gasoline. The alcohols involved can be ethanol. It can also be methanol. In fact, the first flex-fuel cars developed by Ford in the 1980s were methanol-compatible. If you're methanol-compatible, you're also ethanol-compatible as well as butanol-compatible. Methanol is the toughest one to use. They could be made so, again, it only adds about $100 to the cost of a car to make it ethanol, gasoline, flex fuel compared to an all-gasoline car of the same type, and it would only add another $30 and improve materials, components for the fuel line to make it fully methanol compatible as well. Okay? The fact that these cars have only a marginal addition in cost to produce compared to ordinary gasoline-only cars makes it practical to suggest mandating. You couldn't mandate hybrids. You're adding $5,000 to the cost of a car to mandate hybrids. And in fact, they don't do that much good unless they were also a flex-fuel hybrid. But but to simply say that the car has to be flex-fuel, you're adding $100 to the cost of the car. And frankly, if it was made the standard, it wouldn't even add that much because it would be routine to simply produce them that way. Now, you know, this year Detroit is producing 24 models of cars that are flex-fueled, but they only have 3% of the automobile market. Only 3% of auto sales in the U.S. Were flex-fueled last year. And the reason for that is because in most places it doesn't get you anything to buy a flex-fueled car. You can't find an E85 pump in most places. In the Midwest, they're somewhat more prevalent because the state governments are subsidizing them. But in most places, they're very difficult to find. There's only about 1,000 E85 pumps in the whole USA out of 200,000 gas stations. And methanol pumps are virtually unheard of. And the reason why, of course, is that if you're a gas station owner and you got three pumps, you're not going to dedicate one of them to a kind of fuel that only 3% of the cars can use. But if we had a standard that all new cars sold, not made, sold in this country, had to be flex-fueled, within 3 years, we'd have 50 million cars on the road in the United States capable of running on alternate fuels. And in that case, we would see ethanol pumps and methanol pumps at practically every corner gas station. And here's the real kicker. Not just in the United States, but all over the world. Because if we made it the standard that to sell a car in the USA, it has to give the consumer fuel choice, All the foreign car makers would switch their lines over as well. The Japanese are not about to walk away from the American automobile market, neither the Koreans, the Germans, and the other Europeans, none of them. So they would switch their lines over. And what this would mean is that any car being marketed in any serious way anywhere in the world would be a flex-fuel car. And gasoline would be forced to compete at the pump against both methanol and ethanol, made in any number of possible ways, not just in Iowa, but in Argentina, in India, in Kenya, in France, in Japan, Poland, India, everywhere, okay? And this is what would crash the price of oil to $50 a barrel. So what you saw in Brazil, they can't raise the price of gas if there is effective competition at the pump. This would create that globally. This is how we smash OPEC. Now, it may be said that if we had a flex fuel requirement in this country, if all these cars were flex fueled, all capable of running on E85, we'd have a much larger market in this country for ethanol than the American farmer could produce to. That could well be true. If so, that's a great thing. Because what that would mean is we could give the American farmer all the business they could possibly handle and then drop our trade barriers against Latin American ethanol. So Brazilian ethanol, Caribbean ethanol, poor countries like Haiti that are now being looted by the oil cartel. It's obscene. The poorest people in the world being looted by these rich Saudi princes to pay for $130 barrel oil. They would be able, first of all, to make their own fuel because they got sugar potential there and then export to the United States, get a piece of the action of the world fuel business themselves. Similarly, Africa vis-a-vis Europe, South Asia vis-a-vis Japan. So what you're talking about here is taking like $1 trillion a year that is now going to the oil cartel and shifting it to the world agricultural sector. Perhaps half of it going to advanced sector farmers like here in the USA, the other half going to third world farmers. $500 billion to the third world for productive activity, that is huge. You know, you take all the foreign aid in the world, the American foreign aid budget, the United Nations and all its various agencies, the Europeans, and many of them have very generous foreign aid budgets, the Catholic Church, the Red Cross, Oxfam, Christian Aid, the works. You put them all together, that's $60 billion a year is global foreign aid. You're talking about taking $500 billion, directing it towards the third world in this way. That is a terrific financial engine for world development. That is a financial engine for world development on a scale sufficient to seriously address the problem of global poverty. Okay, so that, and what that means for us, in addition to addressing really the biggest problem in the world, okay, it means that instead of us selling Citibank to Saudi princes, we could be selling tractors to Africa. And that's what we ought to be doing. Okay. Now, in addition, okay, clearly it would cut massively into the funding of the jihad, and the threat of superpower confrontation over the Mideast will be greatly mitigated. You know, you see, the problem is with oil is that it is where it is. It's not something that you make, it's something that you take. Okay? And the this is why the Mideast is such a powder keg. You throw a bunch of gold coins into a room full of cutthroats, you're gonna start a fight. Okay? And if the price of oil goes up and up and up, sooner or later one of the great powers is gonna make a snatch and the others will oppose it. This is a formula for war. Okay, the difference with the renewable fuels is they're things that you make. You don't acquire them through force, you acquire them through skill. Okay, and there can be peace because everybody can make their own. And that is the difference between the future of a world based on fixed resources and a world based on resources created through human skill, and creativity, and hard work. A world of peace or a world of war. Okay, the other issues would be addressed as well. Global warming would be mitigated, and the conventional pollution would be reduced as well, as I'll discuss. Now, I do want to mention something, because there is a canard that has been put in circulation saying that it takes more fuel to make the ethanol than the ethanol that you get. And a few of you here may have heard of the gentleman responsible for this falsehood. His name is David Pimentel. He is an insect ecologist from Cornell. Okay, now, Pimentel, you should know, by the way, is not just an opponent of ethanol. He's an opponent of all forms of modern agriculture, irrigation, pesticides, fertilizers, also most forms of industry as well. But he has been refuted in the scientific literature. And here is from a key article by Farrell et al. In Science in January 2006. I cite the article. I have this graph in the book Energy Victory. And they went over the numbers, and they looked at how much petroleum does it take to make a given amount of energy in the form of gasoline compared to corn ethanol. Okay, and here's cellulosic ethanol. But the answer is, even if you use Pimentel's assumptions, which are wrong, it takes five times as much petroleum to make a given amount of fuel as ethanol. And if you use anybody else's assumptions, the more credible researchers, it takes 10 times as much petroleum to make a given amount of fuel as by going into ethanol. Now, Pimentel, you should know, by the way, you should know what his solution is for the energy problem. He says our problem is not that we don't have enough fuel, but that we have too many people. And if we just had government population control programs like they have in China, and we could reduce the American population to 100 million people, we would have all the oil we need. So rather than have this 50-cent a gallon government subsidy for corn ethanol, all we need is government organized population control. So much for Pimentel. It's kind of ironic that he gets constantly cited by libertarian business columnists from the Wahhabi Street Journal as the authority as to why we shouldn't use ethanol. All right. Food versus fuel. I think you know this one is not true. The other speakers have pointed it out. But, you know, last year, U.S. corn exports were the largest in history. U.S. farm exports overall were the largest in history in 2007. In fact, they grew 23% over 2006, and that's by volume, not by cash. Okay, it's not at the expense of soy. Soy production has been going up too. The soy prices are going up because of increased demand from China and India. And you know what the Brazilian representative said is also correct here. We have 1,600 million acres of land in the United States, arable land in the United States, and last year 17 million were used to grow ethanol. So it is about 1% we use to grow the ethanol here. We could grow a lot more if we want to, as I think people here know. Okay. Now, when I was circulating the manuscript for Energy Victory, it was rejected by one very liberal publishing house in New York City who was horrified. Says, how cruel can you be? You want to take away all this money from these poor Arabs. Don't you realize that will get them mad? Well, so what? But let's take the bigger point. Let's look at this from the point of view of social justice. In 2007, Saudi Arabia, with a population of 24 million people, one in six of whom work, okay, pulled in $240 billion in net export profits from its oil exports. The same year, Kenya, with a population of 36 million, the majority of whom work, earned $3 billion in export earnings from a variety of industries and agricultural sectors combined. Okay, so distributed elsewhere, the Saudi oil profits could double the foreign exchange of 80 countries comparable to Kenya. Now, Kenya, I just picked out of a hat, is not a very poor country. In fact, it's not on the UN list of the 50 poorest countries in the world. It's sort of a garden variety, middle-of-the-road, average third-world country. And so if we could distribute this money elsewhere, this would be a terrific thing for large portions of the world that could really use it. And once again, by going to an economy based on biofuels, this kind of wealth transfer becomes possible. Okay, this is a way that we can actually begin to address the deepest and broadest moral problem of our age. Now, you know the answer. Brazil did it. Here's a graph. This just shows a comparison to the United States. In 1980, Brazil was 80% dependent on foreign oil. The United States was 35% dependent on foreign oil. The U.S. is in blue. The Brazil is in red. Today, as a result of their policy, they are 0% dependent on foreign oil, but we are 60. Okay? So this is the difference between having a policy and not having a policy. Okay? It is possible to do this. We've had such bad policy in the U.S. for so many years that people think energy security is just impossible. You can't solve it. It's like teenage juvenile delinquency or something. No, it is possible. You just have to address it. Okay? The environment, I think you know a lot about this. The alcohol fuels pollute much less than gasoline. They burn cleaner. The air quality in the Brazilian cities has improved significantly as a result of shifting to ethanol. Ethanol, of course, is unique. It's the only fuel in the world that is edible. Methanol is not edible, but you shouldn't exaggerate its toxicity. You can't drink gasoline either. Methanol, you should know, by the way, is the main active component of windshield wiper fluid, and we dump hundreds of millions of gallons of that into the environment every year. That's where it goes after it goes off your windshield, and it causes no environmental degradation at all because alcohols are water-soluble, and the world is a water planet. And you release this stuff, it gets washed away into the hydrosphere, then it's biodegraded. If the Exxon Valdez had been carrying ethanol instead of oil, you might have had a few drunk sea otters for a few days. Okay, but after a week or so, there would have been no noticeable environmental contamination at all. They're still dying from the oil slick left over by Exxon Valdez now, a third of a century later. Alcohols cannot cause permanent environmental degradation in the way that petroleum can. It's physically impossible. They also cause less global warming for all the reasons that Bob Dineen pointed out. And there's also an additional reason you should know. Okay, beyond CO2 capture, the global temperatures are also regulated by other things than CO2. For instance, the water cycle. And plants are great global cooling agents because they absorb an enormous amount of heat from the surface of the earth when they evaporate water through their leaves. That heat is then transported from the earth's surface to the upper stratosphere, where it is then released when the stuff condenses. Half of it flies away into space. Okay, that is why it's cooler on a hot day to be on the lawn than on the pavement. It's why Birmingham, Alabama, which is at the same latitude as Baghdad, is much cooler in the summer because Dixie is much better vegetated than Iraq. Okay, so if you want to fight global warming, you want to promote agriculture. To promote agriculture, you go to biofuels. Now, I want to spend a few minutes talking about oil and power. And here I'm not talking about electric power. I'm talking about geostrategic power. Power to rule. See, because the thing you need to know about the oil business is this, is that while the oil business is a huge business, it involves a huge amount of money, it's not fundamentally about money. Bottom of the line, it's not. It's about power. Power to rule. Power to control the destiny of nations. And if you look at the great strategic struggles of the 20th century, what you discover is that control over fuels was completely decisive in all of them. For example, most notably, World War II. The Allies won World War II because we controlled the world's oil. In the 1940s, the United States alone produced 60% of the oil in the world. The Soviet Union, which was our ally, produced another 15%. There was another 10% in Latin America under effective American control, another 10% in the Middle East under effective British control. The Axis only had access to about 5% of the world's oil. They had Indonesia, which the Japanese managed to seize during their advances in 1942. They had the remaining oil fields at Plesti, which was a Nazi ally, the Romanians were. And then the Nazis had their own synthetic oil plants in Leona in central Germany. And this determined the outcome of the war. Germans invaded Russia. When they couldn't get a quick victory, they tried to take the Caucasus, which is where the Soviet oil was. But when they lost at Stalingrad, and Stalingrad was the hinge of their offensive into the Caucasus, they had to withdraw from the Caucasus or they'd be trapped there. They lost their chance to get the Russian oil, which would have given them a serious oil supply. And the Russians had their oil supply secured. They were able to mobilize massive tank armies, putting the Germans into a war of attrition that they could very ill afford. And then the Americans struck. Okay? On August 1st, 1943, American bombers hit Plesti for the first time. This was actually an epic raid. 180 bombers. They had to fly 2,000 miles from Benghazi in North Africa, so no fighter escort was possible. Okay, so they came in at an altitude of 30 feet. Okay, the German 88s on the towers surrounding the field had to shoot down to hit them, which made things lively on the ground for the shells that missed. But the losses were extremely heavy. There were over 200 fighters in the air to meet them. Many of the bombers were actually destroyed by the explosions of their own bombs or explosions set off by the bomber in front of them. Of the 180 bombers, only 79 made it back. Five guys won the Congressional Medal of Honor in that one raid. Okay, but they destroyed 40% of Plesti in a single raid. But because the losses were so enormous, they could not repeat it. And so they had to put it off until 44 when we had the Mustangs, which had long range. And so on May 12, 1944, the Army Air Corps finally hit Leona in central Germany. 935 B-24s completely destroyed Leona in a single raid. OK, Okay, and Albert Speer, who was the German Minister of Armaments, he went there the day after. He wrote it up in his book. He said, I'll never forget that day, May 12, 1944. On that day, the war was lost. Okay, and he was right. Within 3 months, the Nazi Germany was virtually out of fuel. And their last panzer offensive in the Ardennes in December literally ran out of gas on the battlefield because they were out of fuel. And Japan seized Indonesia and managed to hold it through the war, but the American submarines sank their tanker fleet, and as a result, they couldn't get any oil to Japan. And in 1945, Japan, totally on the ropes, in the last year of the war, still produced 10,000 fighter aircraft, but they could not get a single one into the sky to challenge the Enola Gay when she showed up over Hiroshima. No gas. They were just done for, okay? Now, if it had been the other way around, if the Axis had controlled the world oil supplies, they would have won the war easily. The Germans could have conquered England just simply by cutting off their oil exports to England. And there would have been no Royal Air Force in the sky to defend Britain in the Battle of Britain, and no Royal Navy to guard the channel against the German invasion force, let alone the convoys for supplies from America. And the Americans could have done nothing to intervene against the Japanese conquest of China and the rest, because the Japanese and the Germans would have cut off their oil supplies to us. And that's how the whole matter would have been settled. They would have conquered Eurasia and eventually come for us. Control of the world's fuel supply is control of the world's future. We cannot afford to leave this power in the hands of the enemies of freedom. So here's some questions to ask those who are reluctant. Oh, I don't like mandates. Mandates are mandates. Okay, we got mandates in this country for stickers on apples, for crying out loud. All right, let's get down to the basics here. Let's talk about this one. In whose interest is it that the cars not be flex-fueled? Flex-fuel car doesn't force anybody to buy ethanol. It just gives them a choice. In whose interest is it that Americans don't have fuel choice? It's only in the interest of the oil cartel. It's only in the interest of America's enemies. Okay? Should their interests be allowed to prevail, or should ours? This is the question that needs to be asked to every candidate running for office, in particular those running for president. Which side are they on? Okay? Will they support this mandate? So there's a bill is going to be introduced into the Senate this month by Senators Brownback and Salazar and Bayh. It's called the Open Fuel Standards Act. You can get a summary of it at my website, energyvictory.net. Okay. One thing you can do is contact your senators, especially those who are on the Commerce Committee, but all the senators, and ask them to become co-sponsors of this bill. There's a companion bill going to be introduced into the House by Representatives Kingston and Engel. Once again, get your congressman to co-sponsor the Open Fuel Standards Act. And if they won't, they got to explain why they don't want Americans to have fuel choice. Okay? Why they want Hugo Chavez and the Saudis and the Iranians to keep taking money from us and the whole world. Why they want to keep enhancing the enemy's power at the expense of America and all of our friends. Okay? So that's the choice before them. Stick it to them. So this is the choice before us. There is two possible futures for humanity. One based on the petroleum economy, the other on the renewable fuel economy. Okay? Petroleum, again, you don't make it, you take it. So wealth goes to those who take their wealth. And people who take their wealth have no need for human creativity, so they don't need education. They don't need freedom. And this is why countries based primarily on wealth of natural resources have been historically prone to tyranny. And now we're about to see, if this is not stopped, a world controlled by that interest, a world controlled by an interest that has no need, okay, for human potential, has no need for education, has no need for freedom. A world where force rules, not creativity, and therefore a world of war, not a world of peace. A world of economic ruin, as these gangsters essentially tax the world into depression through their control of fixed resources, or a world of prosperity. A world of stagnation, because frankly the people who control this wealth, in case you haven't noticed, don't believe in progress in any field. In Saudi Arabia, it's a capital offense to teach Copernican astronomy. Okay? So are we going to have a future that looks like Star Trek, or are we going to have a future that looks like Taliban Afghanistan? That is the stakes before us here. Okay, A world of tyranny or a world of liberty? These are the choice. The stakes could not be higher. Okay? But, you know, and it's going to be tough. Right now, they've got the upper hand. They've got huge amounts of money. They've got penetration into our political system and European political systems. You know, they're wringing all the propaganda they can. They're counting on every form of human weakness to play in their direction. Okay? It's not easy to beat the people like that. Okay? But, you know, as... Well, we have to. Okay? We've been given a trust. You know, the generation before us saved the world from people of this kind. Okay? And now it's up to us. The weapons are different. Okay? It's weapons of ideas. Okay? We have to win. Okay? It's not going to be easy, but we all have to engage. But, you know, as Tom Paine said in an even earlier time of crisis, said, tyranny like hell is not easily conquered, but the sun never shone on a nobler cause. Let's knock them flat.